Thank you, Tom. We are really fortunate today to have a visionary leader in the oil and gas industry with us. Larry virtually and his team virtually invented the way to combine horizontal drilling with hydraulic fracking to be able to access shale and create the boom that we've all been hearing about and reading about that offers so much promise for America's energy independence. He's also a consummate entrepreneur. His father had been in the oil business for years, had sold out. In 1971, Larry and his father started Devon with, I think, 2.5 full-time employees. And now, of course, the story is well known. It's over 30 billion market cap, 3 billion barrels of oil equivalent, and maybe the largest North American producer. I'm not sure. Larry graduated from Princeton in geology and got a JD from Michigan. And he clerked for Justice Clark and Chief Justice Earl Warren, as well as working for Attorney General Rehnquist in the DOJ. He was also, interestingly enough, the first CEO of an independent oil and gas producer to head up the API, which I think is, in his industry, breaking some serious ground. But the most important things about Larry are that he has an innate sense of right and wrong, and he's legend for this in Oklahoma, and he has consummate integrity. Many people have integrity, but very few people that I've ever met deploy it as broadly and deeply as Larry does in everything that he does. When he was clerking for Justice Rehnquist, the nomination of Harold Carswell came up, and he felt that Nixon lied about it. Obviously, it wasn't the only time Nixon ever lied. He got the offer shortly after that to be assistant White House counsel to John Dean, and because Nixon had lied, he didn't take it. And that just shows you that virtue is rewarded in this world. And he went back to Oklahoma and started Devon with his father. In Oklahoma, in the oil and gas industry, and in all the national organizations that Larry's involved in and affiliated with, he's known for consummate integrity. And the rule in Oklahoma is, whether it's politics or what's good for our state, when Larry steps up, we all follow behind him. So with that, I'd like to introduce Larry Nichols.
My mother would have liked it. Thank you, Francis. That was most generous. We're going to talk a little bit about the evolution of technology in the oil and gas industry in the modern times. When Francis asked me to give this talk almost 2 years ago, I said, the topics you want to talk about will be old hat, and there'll be nothing interesting to talk about that far out. Well, I was wrong. It appears there are interesting things going on. When I was a freshman geologist in my first course, one of the geology professors opened the class by giving a speech where he went back and talked about how at the end of World War I, a learned government study of the time had concluded that all the oil that was coming from Azerbaijan, that fueled part of World War I, that was a geologically unique circumstance. And there was no more oil, and certainly no one knew about natural gas. There was no more oil in the world because that was unique. And the, going forward, society should not think about oil as a fuel. Well, that was wrong. And he went on to show decade after decade, learned study from universities, learned studies from governments, forecasting peak oil, doing all this. Decade after decade, generation after generation, have always been wrong, consistently wrong, and they're always wrong for exactly the same reason. They fail to take account of technology. They fail to take account of the creativity of the human brain. They fail to take account of our free enterprise system, which rewards creativity and which rewards entrepreneurship. And we're going through a period of that right now. Where a combination of new technologies have opened up frontiers that none of us would have dreamed possible just a decade ago. You've all heard about hydraulic fracturing. It has gotten a remarkable amount of notoriety since it's been in existence for over 60 years and has been used widely with no adverse consequences during that 60 years. It's just a method of under great pressure, forcing water with sand into a formation, a tight formation, to try and crack it open so that the gas that's in there will flow out. Never been used successfully, but people for decades have been tinkering around with it. An entrepreneur named George Mitchell was beginning to figure out how to do it in 2000, 2001. We saw it, bought that company, and then combined it with horizontal drilling. You don't hear much about horizontal drilling, but horizontal drilling is really more important than the hydraulic fracturing. It's combining those two together that has really opened up the technology. When we first started doing it, we figured out how to take a well down and turn it at depth at 7, 8, 10,000 feet, and then drill horizontally for up to 500 feet. We thought we might get to 2,000. Today, you can get to 5,000 feet horizontally without any problem. Now, if that's all you do, you would go down and drill a horizontal well, and you'd start, and because formations are not perfectly horizontal, they go up, they go down, they wiggle around, and you would drill for a few feet, and you would drill out of that formation, and you would not know whether that formation was above your drill bit or below your drill bit. Another piece of technology is now as we drill a well, we can get real-time geophysical information from the end of that drill bit as it is drilling. And so we can take that well 10,000 feet under the ground, and as that formation goes up, we'll bend the drill bit and go up. Goes up a little more, bend it, and then go down. And then we can track that formation as it wiggles around underground for over 5,000 feet. That's phenomenal. Picture that you drill a well that is that your formation that you want to get oil or gas out of is 10 feet thick. You drill this well, you drill it 2 miles deep, 10,000 feet into the ground, and you get to this 10-foot formation. You can't possibly get much oil out of that if it's a tight formation. You try hydraulically fracturing it. You can get a little more, but it's not economical. Now, if you can take that well, and instead of opening 10 feet to the drill bit, if you can bend that well and drill 5,000 feet, you now have 5,000 feet of that productive formation open to the drill bit, letting gas and oil flow into that well, as opposed to 10 feet. That's a humongous game changer. That says lots of formations that we have known for generations are productive, have oil and gas in them, but we don't know how to get it out. We now know how to get it out. Historically, our industry has looked for places where gas or oil seeped out of shale formations and were trapped as they seeped out and migrated to the surface, were trapped by structural traps or stratigraphic traps. And we would drill these little bitty areas that have been trapped. Now we know how to go in and drill the source rock itself. The shale, we can now go drill it itself. And instead of having fields that are just little small fields of no real geographic consequence, fields today are entire counties. The original formations that we drilled in North Texas, the Barnett Shale, spills out over 11 counties in the state. Historically, small little wells for a couple of miles square would have been a large well. That has changed things dramatically in our industry. Let me now talk a little bit about how that has had an impact on the structure of the oil and gas industry. If you had gone back to, and students listen to this part, because it's easy when you're a student to look at the world as it is today and think it's always been that way and will always be that way. Wrong. Forget that. Back in the 60s, the 50s and 60s and 70s, our industry consisted of 18 or so large integrated major oil companies, Exxon being the largest. And by integrated, I mean they owned the fields that produced the oil, they owned the pipelines, they owned refineries, they owned the service stations. They owned everything you needed from the well to the consumer was owned in one company. In the 60s and 70s, they really decided that all the oil and gas that had been found in the United States had already been found. And they started looking internationally. They thought that if any small independent happened to find something, then they would have to come to the majors because only they, the majors, had the skills and the capital to really drill large projects. And they thought the international companies would need them forever. And so they focused internationally. The other end of the industry were mom-and-pop companies, and I literally mean that. Companies that had five, six, seven employees. The Independent Petroleum Association of America had thousands of members, average size, seven employees. So these are small little companies, a lot of them formed by people coming out of World War II that entered the business and established a business like my father did of a small, he was just a dad, I wasn't around then, but a small business and prospered in that way. If you look at it now, we no longer have this barbell type industry with the majors over here and the integrateds. The integrateds have essentially gone away. or got, we now only have two. Exxon Mobil, the combination, Chevron, Texaco. They've either merged together like those two entities did, or they've gone away like Kerr McGee and Unocal, or they've divided themselves into two separate entities, the refineries, the refining side of the business, and the pure E&P, because they can't compete with the new E&P companies, like Marathon has done recently and ConocoPhillips. The independents have grown into companies like my company, Devon, but Apache, Anadarko, EOG, to give you some of the names, that are no longer mom and pops. We have 5,200 employees. We used to have a $30 billion market cap. Francis, thank you. It's less than that today. Your information is about 2 weeks old. And I didn't look at the new number because I don't want to know. But dramatic companies that have $5, $6, $7 billion annual drilling budgets. The majors got it wrong because companies like ours can compete here in the United States quite well. As we have discovered these large projects, we don't need to go to the majors for help. We can do that on our own. The technology that I referred to earlier has made us realize there is so much in the United States that companies like Devon have essentially sold out of international. 2 years ago, we sold out all of our international and our Gulf of Mexico, realized about $12 billion for that, so a major reorganization of the company, so we could focus solely on the United States and Canada onshore. And you see Apache doing the same thing. You see lots of the other companies doing the same thing. So if there's any doubt in your mind about the significance of this, you can see the independent companies changing significantly their structure because they see so much available here in the United States that they did not 10 years ago. And you see the integrated companies now trying to come back into the United States. Major shifts that they've done, highlighted by Exxon's acquisition a couple years ago of a pure U.S. gas producer, XTO, that they bought for about $35 million. The consequence of that is that we now have in the United States, literally for the first time in our history, a long list of very large, very well-capitalized companies exclusively focused on the United States. That's a game changer. That is what is driving a lot of this growth, is you have companies that have the capacity to do it. The implications of that are huge. Every president from Richard Nixon to Bush at one time or another in their career, in their presidency, declared, my goal was to make the United States energy independent. And geologists or COEs like me would have looked at that and said, no way. That is a pipe dream. You cannot possibly do that. Interestingly, President Obama is the only president who said that, has not said that, and it's happening in his administration. Go figure. But the impact is that as we grow our resources in this country, we are creating the jobs in the United States, and we can do a dramatically amount more. We are in the position where instead of importing oil from countries that don't like us, that are unstable, like Venezuela, Libya, Nigeria, lots of the Middle East, we're in a position where if we really wanted to, we could start exporting oil. We could start exporting natural gas to countries like Germany so they're less reliant upon Russian natural gas and more inclined to support us in our political endeavors. A significant game changer in the balance of power in world affairs that could be achieved if we had an administration that wanted to head in that direction. We've already made dramatic impact. We are now producing 9 million barrels a day in the United States of oil. The oil production in the United States peaked in 1971, and everyone thought it was in an irreversible decline. We're now have changed that curve, so it's now going back up. We're back to the point where we're producing the amount of oil that we produced in 1985. That is a huge turn. We are now importing less gas, less oil than we have in the last 18 years. Our imports of oil went down 6.7% in the last 12 months. Those are dramatic changes for these large industries. The wealth that can be created here, the taxes that get generated here, that go to better schools and highways and hospitals and everything else, it's a big game changer. jobs. Everyone wants jobs. The five biggest, the five most attractive places for job creation in the United States in the last 5 years, four of those states are oil and gas states. The fifth one is Washington, D.C. I won't make a comment on that one. You can figure that out on your own. But four, all of the top four states outside of the district are oil and gas states that are driving that in places that you would never guess, like North Dakota. That's a phenomenal impact. Now, all of this comes with significant challenges. There are, of course, the challenges that any expanding industry has. We need more infrastructure. We need more pipelines. We need more drilling rigs. We need more trained employees. We have all of those needs. Those will, of course, get solved inevitably in time, and they are getting solved. We have equipment shortages. Those are getting solved as manufacturers ramp up to feed all this. More troubling and more difficult to solve is that we have environmental groups that don't really welcome this. It's interesting if you look at the evolution of environmental thinking toward natural gas. In the first 2 years of the Obama administration, we really didn't exist. Environmentalists did not know that natural gas was there. In Obama's first State of the Union speech, he listed the fuels that he did not like, oil, coal, and nuclear, and he listed the fuels that he did like, wind and solar and all the other alternate fuels, never said what those were, but all the other ones, and he did not mention natural gas. We didn't even get mentioned. Same thing in the second State of the Union speech, which is rather ironic when you realize that, and there's no argument on this statistically, the biggest contributor to the reduction in CO2 in our environment in the last 6 years is the conversion of coal plants to natural gas. As natural gas has taken away business from the coal producers, CO2 has come down. It is by far the largest contributor of the decline in CO2 in the last 6 years. And it comes not from government regulation. It comes from the free enterprise system working quite well.
I said the first period was you don't exist. The next 2 years during this administration, the environmentalists said, well, when challenged about what is the alternate fuel that it's going to get there, they said, well, natural gas is the bridge to the future. And we would sit there and smile and say, well, it's going to be a long bridge, but nevertheless, we'll be glad to be referred to as a bridge to the future. They then shifted and suddenly realized that the amount of natural gas that we're bringing on stream is huge. And there was this revolution that, my God, natural gas is the future. And have then changed their attack to try and have to stop the development of natural gas as best they can. It's interesting to look at what happens when politicians start interfering with the free market. Not that long ago, the alternate fuel of choice was going to be corn-based ethanol. It was the darling of Congress. If you walk down the halls, everyone talked about corn-based ethanol. Today, the environmentalists recognize there have been lots of studies, one from Stanford University, that showed the corn-based ethanol actually consumes slightly more energy than it produces. It is very hard on the environment, because the fertilizer and all of the that is dumped into streams to grow all that corn hurts the environment. It drives up the price of food, and it really is not that consequence. There's one study I read that said if you planted every acre of corn that could be planted, every place that you could plant corn in the United States, you grew only corn on that tract of land, you use all that corn not for food but for fuel, you would replace 15% of the oil that we import internationally. Now, no one talks about corn. It's come and gone. But it still gets about a $12 billion subsidy. People refer to it in Washington as the only nonpartisan fuel that we have. Because if you're a senator, it doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat, if you're from Iowa, and bear in mind that all presidential candidates of both parties have to go through Iowa at one point or another, and they have to genuflect to corn. No one likes it. Senator Dianne Feinstein, a good liberal Democrat from California, once called the subsidies for corn-based fuel the greatest transfer of wealth from the coast to the central part of the United States that the country's ever seen. That was her view of corn-based ethanol. Wind and solar. Wind and solar are valuable alternate sources of energy that have little niches. They only are economic with significant subsidies. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of days ago, and it had this headline above it. Wind power is intermittent, but subsidies are eternal. And Congress is fighting that battle, but because of the balance of power and where people are running, those subsidies tend to get supported by people from all parties. It's hard to get anybody off of a subsidy. There's a dirty little secret about both wind and solar, and that is they're not all that environmentally benign. If you look at solar, there was an article in the New York Times ago, just a couple of months ago, that talked about how the solar panels out in California attract bugs. They're attracted to the light. We all know that from the lights in our own backyards. Birds are attracted to where the bugs are. The heat coming off of those panels sears their wings, and they fall to the ground and start to death. In California, both Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer have introduced legislation restricting the development of solar panels in the Mojave Desert, attractive place. There's a lot of sun there, because to protect the desert fox and the desert tortoise. So it's not all that benign itself. Those turbines go at incredibly fast speeds, and they whack a large number of birds out of the sky, which irritates us in our industry, because there was an incident last summer when a variety of robins and songbirds were killed and found in some ponds, drilling ponds in North Dakota. And the local U.S. attorney filed criminal allegations against the CEOs of those companies. They later were dismissed for killing those songbirds. At the same time that our U.S. government grants permits to wind farms to kill bald eagles and golden eagles and other endangered species. That's not even-handed. You know, that's picking fuels for political reasons. Now, those fuels have good niches. We use solar panels on a lot of our remote well site locations to run batteries there. It's a lot more economical to do those. They have a very valuable source. And if you want to really ask what a greedy gas producer thinks when he sees a wind farm, he's very, very happy. Now, why is that? We all know the wind comes and goes very quickly. And so you need to have, whenever you see a wind farm, you need an alternate fuel that when the wind suddenly dies, and the same thing is true for solar panels, but particularly when the wind suddenly dies, you need to be able to turn on another fuel. Well, you can't turn on a coal plant that fast, and you certainly can't turn it off. Once you got all that coal burning, when the wind picks back up, you can't turn it off. You can't turn a nuclear plant on and off. So you need an alternate source of power that you can turn on and off. And anyone that has a gas range in their kitchen knows you can turn gas on very quickly, very fast, and change the amount of heat you generate very quickly. So whenever you see a wind farm, I will guarantee you nearby there's a gas plant that is producing more electricity than that wind farm is, because otherwise you can't survive it. And you can think, obviously, on a cold winter night, when the wind's not blowing, what's going to heat your house? When the sun goes down and it's cold, it's not a solar panel. It is someone else. So they're good fuels. They're alternate fuels. But they're not going to be where our country needs to go to. The reality is that this country is in a fantastic shape that no one in our industry or any other industry could have really realized the extent to which we have resources that can create jobs here. And rather than restricting supply and restricting access to our historic fuels, we need to recognize that the fuels that got us here, coal, nuclear, oil and gas, coupled with a little wind and a little solar, they're going to be the fuels that we're using 10 and 20 and 30 years ago. And I would challenge you to find any thoughtful study that says anything else. So we need to embrace those industries. We need to figure out how to make them more efficient in their activities and continue to create the wealth and prosperity that comes with energy. Energy is not the problem. It is the solution. So thank you very much.
To commemorate your visit here with us, there's a book on Naples and a book on Marco Island. We'll remember your performance.
Thank you.
Enthusiastically. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Now, Francis with a question.
For the record, Robin Wheeler says this is the most questions ever asked of a speaker here.
Means I confused you.
Larry, how do you safely deal with all the wastewater used in horizontal fracking drilling?
Wastewater and horizontal fracking, you do use a lot of water. We've gotten to the point in most of the areas where we recycle about 85% of that water. The use of the water is overstated. We do use a lot of water. To frack one well, it's about the equivalent of filling up three or four swimming pools in your backyard. It's about the equivalent of watering a typical golf course for 1 week. So it's not, you know, it needs to be taken in the context for all the other uses of water. From our economic standpoint, it costs a lot to buy water, to transport the water. So you inject that water into the ground, most of it comes back. If you had to dispose of it, you can dispose of it in wells that are drilled for that purpose, where you inject it back into the ground at some safe formation. But the better use is to just clean it up and use it again. And that is definitely the direction that we're going in. A lot of study is also being used in finding other materials other than water that we can use to complete these wells.
This is a student question. Do you think that the Keystone Pipeline would benefit our country and the oil industry?
Yes. I'll bet that surprised you. No, it's interesting, the debate on Keystone. It's something that no one would have ever forecasted that would be a problem. Let's look at what it does. Would you rather import, we are going to import oil. Would you rather for the United States to import oil from Canada or Venezuela? We are going to import oil. Would you rather import it by pipeline, which is the cheapest, the least risky way to transport a product, a pipeline? Or would you rather import it on ships, which has the highest level of risk for wrecks and environmental damage? Those are simple questions. Would you rather create the jobs here in the United States that come from that oil, or would you rather create those jobs somewhere else in some other country? In the debate they had, there was a variety of just factually wrong statements that were made, and I will go through them in order. Obama and some of the Democrats in the House said, well, this is only going to benefit Canadian producers. Our industry has people everywhere. Devon, headquartered in Oklahoma, has about 25% of our production is heavy oil in Canada. So is Conoco, so are a lot of other companies. So it benefits a long list of U.S. and Canadian and European and everything else companies. Second misstatement, as you transport the oil, it's only going to be Canadian oil going down to the Texas Gulf. Wrong. Oil will be collected at the Bakken in North Dakota. One of the stops along the way is Cushing, Oklahoma, which historically has been one of the big transportation hubs in our industry, where it collects oil from Oklahoma and West Texas and Colorado and a variety of areas like that before it gets to the Gulf. So it's not just Canadian oil. It's a lot of U.S. oil that will end up in the Gulf Coast, too. And the third thing is it's then going to get exported around the world. That's wrong, too. What the industry has that we have in the Gulf of Mexico will take that oil and do two things with it. Refine it into diesel fuel and aviation fuel and gasoline. Some of it will go to petrochemical plants, which we'll use to make plastics and all of that. And those, in turn, will get exported around the United States. So other than the politics of pleasing the environmental community. Oh, one other thing. The environmentalists don't really argue those points, if you really get serious. Their goal is to stop the oil from being produced in Canada. That's what they want to do, is stop that heavy oil from being produced. Do you think the Canadians are going to let that happen? Absolutely not. The Canadians are already working with the Chinese to build pipelines from Alberta to the Pacific Coast. They're already working with a $12 billion pipeline called Energy East. We'll take that oil across Canada to support their refineries and their petrochemical plants in eastern Canada and get it to ports that can transport that surplus oil around the world. So that oil is going to get produced. The people who are developing the heavy oil in Canada, like us, have not stopped one second in the development because we see all the other activity that is going on inside Canada and realize that that product is going to get to some country. It'll get to Canada, it'll get to China, it'll get to Europe, and if the U.S. doesn't want it, if the U.S. would rather import from Libya and Venezuela than the Canadians, say fine. It has had a very negative impact on Canadian attitude toward the United States. Pick up any Canadian paper, and you will see politicians of all political stripes make statements like this. We no longer can rely upon the United States as our sole trading partner. We should not have all of our eggs in one basket. They're no longer trustworthy. What were we thinking to think all of our oil would go to the United States? We need to diversify. And that thinking is permeating through all the other things that they make up there.
Larry, your last point there is a good segue to this question. What are the macroeconomics and geopolitical implications of $60 oil?
Well, I, of course, know the answer to that, but I can't tell you. One thing to know about oil and gas, since 1973, the price of oil goes up and goes down. It's volatile. We plan for that. Same with natural gas. Whenever there's a time of euphoria, people think it's going to go up forever. Right now, people think it's going to go down forever. In the last week, I read articles about, you know, don't do anything because it's going lower and lower. It's going to go down to $45, maybe. I doubt it. It never does that. It never goes down forever. It never goes up forever. And so if you're a company, you don't know why it's going to go up or down or when, but you know it will. So you put your company in a position like Devon and a lot of others are, where you don't have a lot of debt. All of the wells you operate are wells that operate and generate a profit at a reasonable price. Devon can cover all of our cash cost, the cost of operating wells, our dividends, our taxes, the salaries of all of our employees. All of our costs get covered at $23 a barrel. So we got a big margin out there. Now, we need that big margin in order to fund our $6 billion drilling budget. So am I worried about that? No, for next year. We'll reduce our drilling budget. That's all we have to do, and we know how to do that. And companies that did not behave in that way, that are over-leveraged, that are too small, now's a good time to think about buying them. We have bought a lot of companies during the past several decades since 1971, exactly during these downturns. That's the time you can make good acquisitions. You as investors, it's not a bad time to look at a stock if you ever wanted to get in, because these don't go down forever. And the reason they don't is that a lot of the oil is generated in shaky places. The people that are going to suffer the most are not U.S. Oil and gas companies. Venezuela, Libya, even Mexico. These are countries that need a lot of oil to maintain social peace. The Saudis are in that category, too. People, the Saudis, they can take it way low because it only costs them $10 a barrel to produce oil. True. But they have to pay a huge amount of money to maintain peace among all of their various tribes and religious groups, to keep the Shiites and the Sunnis happy. They have to spend a lot of money maintaining that peace. So if you include that in their operating cost, they've got the same concerns that we do. That stress, I have no idea what country, that stress is going to cause a difficulty in one of those countries. It only takes a couple of bombs well-placed in Libya to shut oil down in that country. Or any of the other countries. And that'll happen sooner or later.
This is a technical question, and it's from one of the students. How does the drill bit bend up and down to follow horizontally for 5,000 feet?
Don't tell anyone in Devon. I'm a geologist, and I don't really understand that. Engineers know about that. I once heard someone make a speech. He said, this was a quote from the 1890s. There are three ways to ruin: alcohol, women, and engineers. The first two are much more reliable and more fun. Are much more fun. The third, the engineers, are much more reliable. A more serious answer is that if you think of a straw, you can bend a straw without breaking it. Under the heat and pressure that exists at 5,000 feet, steel can bend. It can maintain its integrity, but it can bend because it's heated up to that level. And steel can be designed to have exactly that characteristics. So at certain heat and pressure, which exist at 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 feet, you can bend steel and will not lose its structural integrity. That's the real answer.
Another somewhat technical question. What chemicals are typically used in the fracking process, and are any of those hazardous to human health? And do you favor disclosing those to public and local governments so they can protect drinking water and provide proper emergency response if needed?
There are a variety of chemicals that are used. Most of them are designed to make the sand slick so you can inject the sand. A lot of them are household products, although they have long, complicated names. It's really a fall. I'll start backwards with the questions. I don't care whether you disclose it or not. It's information that is so what? You know, look underneath your kitchen sink, and you'll find a lot of those same chemicals. If they got into drinking water, will they cause a problem? Yes. So would a lot of the things you have in your kitchen, in your cleaning closet. Would not want to drink those, so the answer to that is yes. The reality is that there is not a single well in the United States that anyone can document that has caused any problem to drinking water. Not one. The director of the EPA, in sworn testimony before the United States Senate about 9 months ago, agreed in answer to a question that she did not know, the EPA does not know of one single well during the 60-year history of our industry where there has been drinking water that has been harmed by hydraulic fracturing. Not one. Now, the environmental groups are out there trying to scare you to death about that because it sounds spooky. How you could have a problem, we're fracking that water and injecting that a mile or two under a solid, heavy burden of rock. We barely have learned how to get enough energy force down there to crack the rock immediately around the wellbore. To think you could frack that rock for 2 miles is kind of like saying, well, could you go outside this room and yell and they could hear you in Miami? No way. We don't have enough energy to do that. The only way you could have a problem is that if on the surface casing, when our industry drills a well, you drill surface casing that goes down to 500 feet below the lowest known water. You cement that into place. You put another well bore inside that. You cement that into place. And then you have your drill bit, your drilling inside that. So you have three layers of steel and concrete that go down way below the groundwater to protect the groundwater. We live in the places, our employees live in places where we drill these wells. We want to drink the water. The only way you could have a problem, and this would be in drilling any oil and gas well, would be if you employed cheap steel and it fractured. And regulators in the states are very, very good at having very high standards, which the industry is totally cooperative with, in having that surface casing protect the groundwater. And also, I mean, we spent, the average well in the United States costs $9 or $10 million per well. They're cheap relative to offshore. The average cost of an offshore well is $300 million. One well. That's a bad day when you drill a dry hole out there. That's why we sold out. I couldn't stand another $300 million dry hole. We spend all this money to collect the oil and gas. You don't want it leaking out. Forget the ground. You don't want it to leak out. You spend a lot of money to keep that product so you can go sell it.
What is your opinion, Larry, on raising gas taxes to pay for local highway and infrastructure projects?
Well, like anyone, you'd rather tax the other guy, not me. To pay for roads, the trucks and things that we drive up and down areas in the oil and gas industry where we operate do have an impact on roads and bridges, and it's only fair for in those areas to for us to pay for in one way or another the upkeep of the roads and the public facilities that we use. So for those kinds, all in favor of it. For broader taxes, I'm not sure that question is headed toward carbon tax or things like that. I'll dwell on that quickly. If you're an environmentalist and you see this abundance of first natural gas and now the abundance of oil, you think, how am I ever going to make these alternate fuels competitive? I thought I could when the price of gas was $5 and $9 and $10 an MCF. Now it's $3.75. How am I ever going to make that competitive? I have to drive up the cost of oil and natural gas. And they've tried to do that in two different ways. One is by taxes. It started when Bill Clinton tried to pass a BTU tax, and he could not get that done. Obama tried the same thing with cap and trade, which was just a complicated tax system. You now hear carbon tax proposed. All of those are designed to drive up the cost of oil and gasoline that everyone in this room would pay the tax on. And we might be able to afford it, but the lower class will not be able to afford that. The other way you could drive up the price of oil and natural gas is to restrict supply. And you can restrict supply by saying, okay, offshore, we're only going to allow oil and gas drilling in the eastern, in the western half of the Gulf of Mexico. Our nation prohibits all drilling in all of the Pacific coast, all of the Atlantic coast, and all of the eastern half of the Gulf of Mexico. We are the only country in the world that has anywhere near that kind of magnitude of areas where we restrict exploration for hydrocarbons. Of course, we need to restrict it in areas that are environmentally sensitive. But does anyone think the entire Atlantic coast and the entire Pacific coast falls into that category? I doubt it. You restrict supply by not allowing the Keystone Pipeline to come in. You restrict supply by not having permits granted on federal lands. We get permits to drill on lands controlled by states in about a month. It takes a year and a half to get a permit to drill on federal lands. It's why all of the revolution I've been talking about, all of it, comes from non-federal lands. So whenever you hear anything that someone is proposing, you can put it in one of those two categories. It's either a tax, and its ultimate purpose is to drive up the cost of the energy, or it's a restriction on supply one way or another, the ultimate purpose to drive up the cost of energy to try and make to make alternate fuels competitive.
Okay, we'll return to more of a technical question. What is the quality of the oil produced by horizontal wells and hydraulic fracking, say, for example, versus Saudi Arabian light crude?
The quality of oil drilled by horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing is all the above. It can be heavy oil, it can be light sweet crude like the Saudis, it can be the whole range of oil. The technology itself can be used for all kinds of oil and natural gas.
Okay. Given that you got out of offshore, this question is, what is the future of offshore drilling in light of Macondo and the shale revolution?
There are companies. Obviously, we got out. Because the risk-reward just didn't make sense to us. There are great opportunities out there. The capital cost and the time delays are huge. I said it cost the average well is about $300 million to drill one well. If you want to build a pipe, and after you drilled five or six of those, you then need to build a platform of one kind or another that can process the oil and collect it and put it on pipelines or barges to get it to shore. Those cost multi-billion dollars, and they take forever. Devon drilled one of the first offshore discoveries, Cascade, in 2002. The company we sold it to, Shell, just got that field on stream last year. It took 11 years. Now, there's no way you make money on an investment where you spend the dollars in year one and you don't begin to get any return for 11 years. The majors are there because they have to. They need those bid projects. They're trying to make them economical, and I wish them well. We won't be there.
Are the Oklahoma earthquakes caused by fracking?
They're not caused by fracking, but they could be caused by injecting water into the formation. If you take wastewater and instead of recycling it as we're doing and trying to do now, but inject it into formations that are receptive to having water, porous formations that you can inject them into, there's a theoretical model out there in a few isolated cases where it might have happened, where you inject water into a fault zone. A fault zone is an area where the rock, one air part of the earth is moving against the other. They're everywhere. It's a natural part of mountain building and valley building and ocean building that has been around forever. Earthquakes are common. They've existed in California forever, and they will as these tectonic plates move against each other. If you were to, and they're small faults, so they're not just the big giant ones in California, they're small ones. If you were to inject water into one of those fault zones, the water could lubricate the fault zone and make an earthquake that was going to happen anyway sooner or later, make it happen now, because it would lubricate the tension between those two blocks moving in different directions and could cause an earthquake. A simple solution to that is that before any state, and the states have already figured this out and are doing it, before any state allows for a disposal well to be drilled, you do the underground geology and you figure out whether this is an area that is prone to earthquakes, that is prone to those kinds of seismic events. And if it is, you don't allow the well to be placed there. Now, having said that, earthquakes have come and gone in Oklahoma and elsewhere forever. There is a Nemahal Ridge, an underground ridge about 6,000 feet deep, goes right under Oklahoma City, where there is this historic tension that has existed. So earthquakes are a natural phenomena, and they actually could have. There are some earthquakes, that minor ones, that could have been induced by water.
Are the Middle East oil producers trying to put the U.S. producers out of business?
Yes. This has not been documented, so I'm not sure what I'm telling you is true. But I've heard people I think are in a position to know that a lot of the environmental groups, the anti-fracking groups that are out there, are being funded by Kuwaitis and people from the United Arab Emirates. Now, that's kind of disquieting. You know, that's not playing fair. Because they don't like the revolution that we've had in this country. They don't like all that oil. Put us out of business, I don't know if they go that far. But clearly the Middle East producers are dealing with a new phenomena. There's a lot more oil there. The Saudis reacting the way they did is not a surprise to me, because if the Saudis were to keep contracting their oil production, and everyone else in the U.S. and elsewhere were to keep expanding their oil production, pretty soon they don't have enough to run their own country. And so they have to say, wait a minute, we're going to have some impact on other producers in the world before we bring our oil back on stream. You can debate whether that was Russia or Venezuela or some of these other countries that will really have problems. I'm not sure they really care, but would they like to see supply disruptions happen somewhere in the world to take a little of this surplus oil out? I suspect they would.
Okay, after all the recycling and the wells that you talked about, how do you safely deal with all the wastewater that nets up and being used in horizontal wells and hydraulic fracking?
The what?
The wastewater. Once you've done the recycling and all that, the disposition of the waste chemicals.
Oh, you clean the water up and reinject it. The processes that we have to clean water up, we have used. And let me give you an example. In Canada, where we use water in our production there, we drill wells that only access, this won't be a long question, so don't give up entirely, where we drill saltwater wells. We drill wells that only access saline water, water that is not fit for either human or animal consumption. We bring that water to the surface. We clean it up so it's pure. We use it to make steam and to produce the oil there. We recycle the oil and keep cleaning it up. So I think the future for water use in our industry is both to be able to clean it up, which we're making great progress on, so that you only use non-potable water. You clean it up and you recycle it.
Do we have time for one more time?
Yeah,
Larry, could you give us a quick opinion on the political opportunity for repealing the ban on exporting oil?
No. You know, that's a political question. If you look at it logically, our country historically has believed, let's go back to basic principles. Our country historically has believed in free trade. Free trade drives a lot of the world economy. If we started restricting our products, other people would restrict what they export here. You can certainly make a case that, well, a convincing case that we should not export certain things. We should not export nuclear weapons or ships, military ships or fighters, unless we know exactly where they're going. We should not export things like that that are in our nation's security interest. We might not want to export anything that is scarce commodity. We have an abundance of oil and an abundance of natural gas. So there's no logical reason to ban the export of oil as opposed to other products. Dow Chemical is really being the company leading the charge in trying to keep the ban for the export of oil in place. What they want to do is they want to use that oil, convert it into products that they can then sell internationally. They'll convert natural gas into pellets of different chemicals that they can then export internationally. There's no principle in that. That's just self-interest run amok. We need to be able to export all of the commodities in this country. It helps our balance of payment. It helps create jobs here. It helps create taxes here. Why not?
Thank you very much,
Bob. Thank you.
Thank you all. We're adjourned. Have a nice day.